welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. I still can't stop laughing when I hear this woman on Zoom. If no one hears it apart from us, right? And this dodgy American voice. Yeah. I think they need an English voice, Mike, really, I think.
I'm sure given Zoom's share price is up 70% since this started, I'm sure they can afford to put an English voice on there as well.
Wow. Well, they're doing some good development work. There's no doubt about that. So
I think that, you know, the thing is that, you know, it just shows, goodness knows how many investors would have been in there thinking, you know, how am I ever going to get my money back? And then suddenly overnight, you know, the whole thing goes nuts because of this.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? But like, for everyone that doesn't know, you're Michael Tobin, OBE, and you're a regular guest, thankfully, on my podcast. You've supported me since you were the first episode on my own show, because I had to move it because my other show went pear-shaped. And so I just moved your episode, changed the bits and pieces and put it on there. And then I relaxed, yeah. I was like, oh, it's okay, I can relax now. And I hear these words in my head saying, you're not working hard enough. It was like my dad shouting at me, you're not working hard enough. So then I was like, launched all these shows, and then got approached by the world's largest ebook producer. And they said, we want you to create some expert talks. So I negotiated with them, and since your episode and the work we've done together really went down really well within their platform. So I've actually got 92 episodes within that thing, and it killed me. It was exhausting, this thing. However, we're not here to talk about me. I want to know all about your trekking in the wilderness, because you went off to the South Pole. And, you know, this episode's called Trekking in the Wilderness with Mike Tobin. And then obviously we've got to address what's going on with the current climate. So we're back to harsh reality for a lot of people. And it's a sad time, but I want to know about the trip. That's super exciting. So please fill me in.
So a very good friend of mine, Lewis Moody, the ex-England rugby captain, is quite passionate about one particular charity, which is the brain tumour charity. And brain tumors affect people of all ages, and you know, it's completely indiscriminate, and it's actually the biggest cancer killer of children and people under 40. So he said, let's do something really crazy. And obviously the previous sort of rather crazy thing I did was my 40 marathons in 40 days. So, you know, I think he already had a sort of a reference point of what crazy meant, but, he said, yeah, it's something really, really crazy and raise a lot of money. And so, you know, we came up with this, trekking to the South Pole. And in the end, we managed to find, seven other crazy people to join us. And, as a group of nine, we set off on December 31st. So the first thing was I had to explain to my wife, who had already booked a New Year's Eve party, to cancel it because I had to leave at 7 p.m. on New Year's Eve. Funny enough, New Year's Eve was the day that they discovered the first coronavirus victim.
Wow.
So it shows how fast all of this has moved. So December 31st.
That's crazy.
And I was on a plane over to Santiago. And basically, you know, this trek was the most brutal and crazy thing I've ever done in my life. I mean, the temperature was minus 50. You know, you can see on a clear day, you can see for 30 kilometers in every direction. It's as monotonous as anything. You've got 24 hours daylight. You're walking for 12 hours a day with 15 minute breaks every 2 hours. It's just unbelievably painful and unbelievably brutal. But, you know, when you look at it in context, you know, it was a month out of my life, whereas we raised nearly £500,000 for children with brain tumours. And, wow. You know, you think about what they're going through, then everything, even today's environment of corona and everything else, it doesn't feel, you know, I saw an article the other day where someone was saying, you know, it's, you know, you're being told to stay at home and watch Netflix. How bad can it be? You know, it's kind of compared to some of the challenges that people have. And you know, I think going through the pain of that trek was hard, but all the time in the back of your mind is relativize everything here, relativize it, you know. And when you remember the pain that especially kids go through with things like brain tumors, and they haven't even had a life yet, and they haven't to
endure,
then that drives you on. But I mean, yeah, we had one guy had his tooth explode in his mouth because the minus 50 degree temperature going in, and he had a hairline fracture in his tooth, and it froze inside, and it literally exploded in his mouth, and he pulled it out with pliers. And went the last 4 or 5 days with his blood dripping down and freezing in his beard and everything. And and one guy collapsed 3 hours from the end, if you could believe that. If you imagine at the South Pole, there's a research center, and when we finally imagine walking for days and days and days with no view, just using a compass to go in the right direction, and you're on, you know, you've got blizzards, and then you've got clear skies, you know, and finally, in the distance, right on the horizon, you see these tiny little black dots, which are the buildings of the research center. And you finally got something to head for. And then you realize, actually, it's another 3 days away to get there, because because you can see them, you're still 30 kilometers and you're only doing about 10K a day. and so, you know, this starts to be, you know, with a big boost of kind of adrenaline, you go, yeah, I can finally see the destination. And then after 2 further days of not getting much closer, you go, bloody hell. and then we were 3 hours away from the end. And the guy collapsed with hypothermia and shivering uncontrollably. We quickly made a tent and put the last of the fuel on that we were using to boil water. Because we were so close, we managed to send a message to the research center to come out on a ski-mobile and drag him into the medical center. And he made a full recovery, but you know, that was quite brutal. We had two guys that had snow blindness; their eyes were puffed out with goo in them and everything. And again, we didn't have much in terms of sort of medical support. We had this guy had a couple of chamomile tea bags, so we put them on his eye and gaffer taped them to his head, and that kind of, you know, eventually made them better.
Gaffer tape, it's great for everything, right?
Yeah, if in doubt, gaffer tape it. So and then, you know, we had lots of blisters and chafing, and you know, I mean, the it was absolutely brutal. I mean, everyone had so when I came back, I had no sensation at all in my hands and feet, and slowly after about 3 to 4 weeks, that sensation started to come back in my hands. But you know, even today, I've got a tiny bit of one finger that I have no feeling in, and that's nearly 3 months later. So wow. You know, that's probably not coming back now. That's gone.
Yeah.
But you know, the experience was unbelievable. I mean, you know, you, there's nothing that I could remotely describe that would pay due justice to the actual experience. But it was brutal.
Yeah. It's.
I won't be doing it again.
No, well, you said that about the 40 marathons. You said I still haven't done
40 marathons again, but you know, I think that I've got one more big challenge in me, but we won't talk about that now. I've got to get that through the wife gate first before I can approve to talk about it in public.
But I want to introduce you to someone. Actually, sooner or later, I will. He rides around my local city normally on a penny farthing. Okay. He's completely eccentric and he's basically a history buff completely. And so what happened was, in the space, this is puts everything into perspective. Yeah. Within 1 week, he got diagnosed with leukemia. His girlfriend or fiance left him and he lost his job. This was like 3.5 years ago or four years ago. So what he did was he said, right, okay, I'm going to take my redundancy. I'm going to sell the house. And I'm going to go on a medieval pilgrimage. And he walked, seriously, he walked in a monk's outfit, yeah, to Canterbury, right, from Chichester. And he basically, he wrote to the Pope and he wrote to the Archbishop and he said, look, guys, he's not religious, but he wrote to him. He said, look, can I sleep in the church? Because, you know, if I get cold, it's January and I'm going to freeze. They're like, sure. They wrote back to him, sure. So he actually walked all the way and he stopped in Winchester on the way and he bumped into this homeless guy who'd heard all about him. And he said, oh, I've got a Cornish pasty for you. And he gave him a Cornish pasty. The homeless guy gave him a Cornish pasty. right? Yeah. And he said, have you got any money to the homeless guy? He said, no, but we look after our own. Yeah. And like, but he's done the space hopper over the Alps. Like, you guys need to chat. You could come up with like the wackiest idea, really.
Yeah. Well, I hope he does it for charity, because obviously
he does it to raise homelessness awareness. That's right. What he's doing it for. Literally just to raise the awareness of it. And I hope from the situation we're going through now, maybe that's going to change something in this respect, you know?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, for about 6 or 7 years, I created a charity about a decade ago, which was for Action for Children, supported Action for Children, which we used to get CEOs to sleep in Paternoster Square in front of St. Paul's, in front of London Stock Exchange. And we'd raise £250,000 for one night. Just for homeless children, and there's like 60,000 homeless children in the UK. It's quite extraordinary, because what we don't think about is like the sofa surfers of the world, right? So kids that kind of might sleep on someone's settee and then go to another friend and sleep there, and we don't consider them homeless because they're not on the street, but they are homeless, and you know, and they're also extremely vulnerable because people that are friendly are suddenly seen as kind of, you know, good people, but they may not be that good people, if you know what I mean. So. So we did that for 6-7 years and raised $250,000 every year for one night. And one of the chaps, actually, I think he was the CEO of CEO of ITN. I'm trying to think of his name now. Hardy. So he said one time, he said in the morning, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and you know, you can't sleep all night because you've got foxes the size of large dogs running around, even in the center of London. You've got, you know, the cleaners, the street cleaners to empty in the rubbish, and the big trucks coming around. And, you know, you've got tramps and people that are really homeless. You know, you're worried about them attacking you. And so this is a real kind of, it's almost impossible to get any rest. And in the morning, yes, Ian Hardy, I think his name, he said to me, "Oh, Mike, I'm really glad I did this. I really understand now. I really feel the kind of, what it's like to be homeless." And I said, "Well, you kind of do and you kind of don't, right? Because yes, you've experienced all the physical stuff that happens every day, but you were able to endure it because you knew that it was only once, right? And in the morning, you were going to go off and take your sleeping bag and go and get a shower, and you're back in the office. Whereas these guys have no exit. They have no kind of, if I just hold on for 3 days, it's going to be over. You know, there is never an end to this. So, and that is a demoralizing factor that stops you enduring, right? And you know, when one of the important things about anything, like the current situation we're in at the moment, or you know, any challenge in life, you know, if you have an exit, a view of the exit, then it's a much easier challenge to endure than if you have no view of the exit. And you're just surviving from one day to the next, right? Because the demoralization of that feeling kills all the optimism and the energy and everything else that you can drive for if you believe it's a finite thing.
Yeah.
So you know, the conversation I had with him was, you know, he was like, "I really do understand now. Yes, you kind of get a flavor of it, but you don't, because we're not in that space. We're not in that, you know, hopeless environment of never ending." So I think, you know, that's a good lesson for all sorts of things, really. If you don't, you know, if you're trying to get through something, right, it's not about what, in a way, the human body is incredible. Physically, it'll go through anything you want to put it through, you know, barring sort of throwing it on a fire or something. But you know, the endurance that your body has just inherently is way beyond your mind's capability of understanding it. But you've got to have the other side. You've got to see the other side. If you're just walking into something that doesn't have another side, your mind effectively doesn't allow your body to do it. But if you can see the other side, your mind just drives everything through.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think a lot, you know, some people listening to this might be down to their last can of baked beans. Yeah, like, we don't know who's listening to this. And, you know, it is tough. Yeah, because that feeling of not knowing when it's going to end is the worst. Yeah. But you got to have hope. Yeah. And talk to some people who understand. They might not help you financially, but they might help you emotionally. And if you can just control how you feel, it will be over. It's going to be one way or the other. Yeah, either you're going to die or you're going to get through this. So,
so I think that's an interesting thing, is that you know, there's a lovely passage which I think is attributed to Goethe. And I'm not even sure, because I've read some sort of conspiracy theories that maybe he didn't actually write it, but it's attributed to him anyway. So what he talks about some climbers on Everest, and they get to a certain point where they've left their camp and they're heading to the next one, and the storm comes in, and they kind of go, well, the storm's worse behind us, but we're closer back to there. So do we go back through the worst storm to try and get back to where we were, or do we just push on through, which is much further? And we have no idea how, you know, whether we're going to get to the next point. And this whole thing is about sort of sitting there dithering about things, right? It is not going to answer either of those solutions. But once you make a decision in life, and once you say, I'm committing to an exit, you know, a result, then all manner of fortune falls in your way. And, you know, and then he talks about the fact that this crevasse that they come across, and then there was a mini avalanche, and it filled the crevasse, and they were walk across, and all these things where you could never imagine achieving something, but because of fortune and what we define as luck, they end up delivering. But it only comes to you once you've made a conscious decision to take a direction, and I think that this is one of the challenges that sort of homeless and people that they've lost the direction, right, and therefore they're sitting in this stasis because they feel that everything around is worse than the stasis. And you know, it could well be, but I think that's where we need to help people like that, is to give them the inspiration of having a direction. And then all manner of fortune, you know, when I was with, in the early days of Telecity and back when it was called Redbus, which was a data center company, and we were bankrupt basically. We had 6 million, and it was a listed company on the stock exchange. We had 6 million in the bank, and we were burning 2.8 million a month. And I just came in, I didn't do my due diligence properly, and we were about to go bankrupt. And I'd gone off to Prague to open this data center in Prague. And these things, for those of you who don't know a data center, it's great big buildings where the internet lives. So what we're doing right now is running on servers in data centers somewhere, right? And I'd sit there, we'd open this big building, and there was no way back in 2002, 2003, there was no way that we were ever going to fill this. And the physical building was costing money running. So it was contributing to our demise with no hope of actually making any money in the near future. And I remember getting back on the plane, coming back to London, thinking this is a nightmare. And it was a bumpy old ride. And I got back to London, and there were storms everywhere. And then in the morning, I read in the newspaper there was the great floods of Prague, and the Danube had burst its banks, and my data center had just flooded, and it was insured for 48 million quid. So I got back on a plane, flew back out there, and I went straight to the insurers. I said, look, it's insured for 48 million. Give me 8 million quid, and I'm out of here. And of course, for him, that was like a fantastic result from his debt position. And so we cut a deal on the day of 8 million. And then that 8 million gave us enough time for me to resize the business and restructure it and survive. And of course, 13 years later, we sold it for 3.6 billion. So it was a good gig. But all of that was luck, right? I mean, I couldn't control the weather. I couldn't. And when you kind of think about, you know, survival and fortune, and you know, I didn't even know why I was going out there at that time, because I knew the business was going to be bankrupt in 2 months.
Yeah,
right. And so, but sometimes this fortune falls in your way if you're open to seeing it, right? And I think, you know, when you're a homeless person, your eyes to opportunity are just completely closed, quite justifiably. And that's, I think, one of the biggest things we can do to people is help them get to a point where their eyes can be opened again.
Yeah.
And that needs care and support and everything else. But
yeah, it's challenging. Yeah, but maybe that's going to happen right now in this current climate. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, my local church I go to on a Sunday, they've started live streaming, right, on a Sunday now, just this Sunday gone. And they actually are feeding the homeless from the church, doing a home soup kitchen every day. Yeah. In that church, they are cooking. The priests are cooking for the homeless, yeah? And you know, I think that there is compassion. I think this experience is going to help people get through to the next stage in their lives, right? Like, and if they actually, you know, take the courses that are out there that are free. Yeah. Do the courses that they want to learn. I mean, I started learning about opera yesterday morning at 5:30 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. I woke up and there was this like Facebook post to a friend of mine with all these MOOCs. Yeah. These open courses. Right. And I was like, because my girlfriend, she's into opera. Yeah. So I was like, wow, I can study opera. And like, so at 5:30 in the morning, there's me listening to opera before I went down the supermarket. But
well, it does help if your girlfriend's into it. I mean, yeah. You know, so you have some, you know, sort of some commonality there.
Yeah, exactly. But it would help if she was in the same country. Yeah. Anyhow.
Okay, yeah. That she's still abroad, right?
She lives abroad. Yeah. So.
No travel, no nothing.
Nope. Anyhow, so. That leads on beautifully to, you know, how to get through working from home.
Well, I think, look, I mean, you know, it's not difficult to work from home if we really think about it. I mean, you know, the luxury of being able to work from home rather than the challenges of it, right, are that obviously, you know, we're sitting here in our scruffs. We don't have to get a suit and tie on. We don't have to go around and free hugs. Well, Oh, they're virtual hugs, are they?
There's a smiley face, yeah, but no one wants a hug right now. Look, no one wants a hug.
I'm in BA pajamas. Look, that's first.
What's that, Mike?
First class BA pajamas.
I can't hear you there, Mike.
I said it's first class BA pajamas.
Hold on, I'm going to just pause this video. Well, I'm really sorry. That was me. I actually got so excited about giving people free hugs.
You stood on the cable, did you?
Yeah, I stood on the cable, yeah. I'm looking at Mike going, Mike, what did you do there?
you thought I'll just remove the audio just like that?
Well, you stood up as well, so I wasn't quite sure who...
I was saying, look, I'm wearing my BA pyjamas, look.
Ah.
So yeah, I'm in my scruffs here.
Yeah.
But working from home, of course, right? And I think that, you know, we should see this in a way. And I know it's kind of a little perverse to say it because there are people suffering all around the world at the moment, but we should see it as an opportunity as well to think about how we work. And you know, there are many jobs that cannot be done at home, but there are many jobs that can, right? I mean, you know, anyone that works in an office in theory should be working from home.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that, you know, when you look at where the world goes from here, I think, you know, we have the technical capability of autonomous vehicles, right? So if you think about how, you know, taxi driving, bus driving, all those things could easily be replaced, right, by technology. Now, think about that. What would be the good and bad to society about that? Well, first of all, tremendous good because, you know, there would be no transmission of disease. There'd be no, you know, driving would be better because nobody would have any accidents because, you know, cars avoid themselves automatically. But they're, you know, driving is the biggest employment category in the whole of the United States, right? If you think about the truck drivers, taxi drivers, bus drivers, you know, it is the biggest employer. So all of those people have to find a different job. So it's going to be a nightmare for a massive percentage of the population, but does that mean it's wrong, right? And you kind of think about, well, you know, the moral issues about advancement of technology, and I'm all for, you know, using technology where we can, but you know, your comment earlier about sort of learning about opera is quite interesting because we all need to learn about stuff that we don't know about, right? Otherwise, tomorrow something like this could happen and boom, you know, we're out of employment.
Yeah. Well, and I need to learn about cable management, Mike.
Well, just simple stuff, you know, mind where you put your size 11s, right?
But, you know, like you're completely right about the autonomous vehicles, because actually they've what I noticed I was reading about is a UV light now, which can actually kill a lot of these germs. Yeah. So if they can actually have a UV light in that vehicle, when the passengers get out, right, all they need to do is when someone gets in to somehow clean the handle, right, that is a clean vehicle.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you've still got to rely on the driver being, you know, not infected or something and turning around and like chatting away to you. But other than that, I mean, you know, autonomous vehicles per se, You know, there's no risk of, as you say, if you clean it. There was a hotel chain in France like 20 years ago now. It was called Formula One. If anyone wants to kind of Google that one, Formula One, and they were horrible little hotels. They were like, I want to say this is probably bad to Ibis, but they were much smaller than Ibis even, right? So, and you used to go there, and basically you'd put your credit card in at the front door, and then it would give you a code, and you tap the code in, and that would open the front door, and then you go in, and you have a room which is basically a tiny bed and a shower and a toilet in a kind of a fiberglass room. And what would happen is at the end of your stay, when you checked out again in the morning, the fiberglass room would just like literally douse itself and disinfect itself. So that was the toilet, the shower, everything, and which is like that, and was ready for the next person. And it's almost like you could do that in a taxi, you know, not with water, but with some form of, you know, you say UV light disinfectant, boom.
It doesn't kill everything, that light. Yeah, but if you combine that with some other stuff, you could do that, right?
And yeah, so when you fly back from Hong Kong or Singapore, even way before this, you know, every time you'd land in London, you know, so half an hour before landing, they'd come through the cabin with these kind of sprays, and they'd just walk from one end of the airplane to the other, just disinfecting it. And so, you know, there must be some combination of things that you could do in public transport that would just effectively stop the transmission from one passenger to the next.
Yeah, well, also with the monitoring that's going to be going on, you know, we're going to have, you know, on my iWatch, right, you can have a temperature sensor band, which is now, you know about that, right? So you'll be able to combine all that. What's that?
I guess the thing is, how far do we go before we, you know, as human beings, we're kind of conditioned into not liking the concept of Big Brother, right? You know, we don't want to be watched. You know, it's like, okay, you know, I don't like the fact that someone's listening to my phone calls on a global basis, just listening to it for the words, you know, bomb or Al Qaeda or something. Yeah. But why wouldn't you want that, right? It's keeping you safe.
Yeah.
You know, and unless you're a perpetrator of bad things, isn't that a good thing that someone's listening? You know what I mean? And everyone kind of gets hung up about the sort of, you know, human rights or freedom of, not freedom of speech, but sort of my own personal space. You know, when I lived in Denmark, and we're going back, you know, God, 25 years now, I remember I moved there, and the first thing you have to do is kind of get an ID card and then open a bank account. And, you know, and I got into the bank and I said, can I open a bank account? And they went, oh, yeah, it's fine. You know, we'll get you a credit card made up. Would you like your picture on your credit card as an extra form of security? And this is 25 years ago, right?
Wow.
And I went, yeah, but that'd be very cool. But to be honest, right, it's 3:30 now. I don't want to have to go back and go into a photo booth, get my picture, come back to you. You put it on. I said, oh, no, don't worry about that. Don't worry. Have you got your ID card? I said, yeah. And they put my ID card into the computer, right, and downloaded all my personal details from the government side and whacked my picture onto the credit card, and they took the credit card out pre-made, right? And I thought, that's amazing. And then at the end of the year, they sent me a pre-filled-in tax return. Pre-filled-in tax return with all the details of all my bank accounts and everything on it. And all I had to do is sign it and give it back. And now some people went nuts on this. They go like, how dare, that's my information. And I said, well, as long as you're not doing anything bad, why wouldn't you let someone else do all the hard work for you?
Yeah.
Right? So there's a way, you know, the things that some people call liberty, right? I reverse that view and say the liberty is not having to do, my freedom is not having to deal with all that crap, right? If someone else deals with it for me, right? Then that's great, isn't it? As long as you're not a bad person, why would you care, right? As long as you're not trying to cheat the system, why would you care? And so I think, you know, that all of these things about the world understanding more about you, like having a watch here that I, you know, the first thing is having a watch that identifies your heartbeat and your pulse rate and your temperature. Right?
Love it.
The second thing is sending it off to the government to say, come round. Even if it happens while I'm asleep, I'd like you to come and knock on the door, wake me up and deal with it, rather than me panicking about that, right? Yeah. So why wouldn't I want you to have that information, right? So, you know, then we kind of worry about who else can kind of hack into it and things like that. But that's another debate, right? We already have enough of our data out there in the world for us to worry about, then, you know, that's, there are infinitely more things that are valuable to us by globalizing our data than there are negative to us.
Yeah, I agree completely. How do you think they prevent terrorist attacks in airports? Yeah, you think that they do that by magic? Yeah, they do that by analyzing like video, right? Like, well, so, suspicious, you know, people. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, running data centers. You know, in the UK, for example, the data centers we have in London, 92% of all Britain's internet traffic flows through one building, right, in Canary Wharf. And so, you know, if you want to understand what's going on in terms of chatter, right, then there are certain buildings around the world that literally you could capture, you know, a massive proportion of all traffic. And there are devices that they're called sniffers that you can just clip around. You don't even have to put much in there. You clip around the outside of a cable and you can work out what's going through that cable in terms of data, right? And then you just sniff for special words.
Yeah. I mean, we're all being watched, yeah? I mean, like, literally, I was in Poland about a month ago, and my phone rung, yeah? So I had a meeting on the phone, yeah. And literally, after about 3 minutes, the guy repeated exactly what he just said to me for about, yeah, for about 30 seconds. And I thought I was going mad. I was like, you just said that. And and this carried on three times. That recording was played to me before I went, hold on, you're nuts, mate, and hung up, yeah? And then he called me. And so someone somewhere had recorded what I was saying and played it back to me three times. Yeah. Yeah. You know, like, come on.
Well, that was a glitch in the system, because they're not really, they record a hell of a lot of what's going on. Secondly, they're not interested in almost 99.99% of it.
No. Right? I had nothing interesting to say.
The quicker, you know, the quicker they can re-record over the top of anything uninteresting, the better, right? Because that's, yeah, true. And so when we think about our human rights and saying, oh, you know, Big Brother's listening, who cares, right? They're not listening for, no one's interested in what you and I are saying. No, that's a sad thing for your podcast, but I mean, I mean, you know, no one in terms of, you know, the national security is interested in what we're saying, right? But what they're doing is they're filtering everything to understand who is talking about that. And so we should be pleased that that kind of filter is there. I mean, you know, we have filters in all parts of our life. I mean, you know, when I was working with a business in Nigeria, data centers in Nigeria, and what they do is that when the guy comes and, so data centers have to run 24/7. So they have diesel generators that back up the power. So if the grid goes down, you kick in the diesels and you run on diesel power until the grid comes back, right? And so you have to have big tanks of diesel to run these diesel engines, and you have guaranteed delivery so that you can run them permanently if you need to.
Right.
Anyway, so when these big trucks of diesel fuel come along to reload your tanks, right, the first thing you do, of course, is you monitor and you filter what diesel's coming in, because you say, well, I don't trust you to have actually not siphoned off half my diesel and put water in it or something like that. So you go through a filter first and work out that it's proper. Mm-hmm. Otherwise it ruins your system. Now everything is being filtered. Our entire lives are filtered, right? To one extent or another. And the most important parts of this filter is making sure that we're safe. And yet that's the one we seem to have a big problem with, because we see it as an invasion of our civil liberties, but it's not, it's keeping us safe.
Well, especially if you can marry that data with, you know, like they've done in Singapore with this virus, and you can turn around and track down who these people are, where they've been, who they've spent time with. Then when people get to the airport, you're like, no, you're not going on that plane, mate. You're off. Get in quarantine, son. You know, it's an easy fix, really.
Well, we have so much technology around us and we hardly use it. And one of the main reasons we don't use it is humankind's ability to accept technology, right? So we've got more solutions out there than you can shake a stick at, but our ability to absorb goes at went back in the day when it was like replace a man pulled plow with an ox pulled plow, that took a generation to get through, right? It's like, yeah, great. And then, you know, and it was, but the rate of change today is changing faster than our minds can absorb. Right. So we always put these human blockers in the way of technology, which, you know, don't need to be there. Yeah. So, you know, we are the biggest blocker of progress in the world today.
Yeah, I agree. So I know we had this one last topic. Have you got time for that, or do you want me to cut?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. So this one is a big one, yeah, because people are really worried. They don't know what the hell they're doing, and we've already covered the fact that they need to be studying, yeah. If you find yourself at home and you're sitting down and you're like really stressed out, you need to study something. Think about anything that you're interested in. Go online and find some MOOCs. Yeah. MOOCs are free courses. They're everywhere. And go and study. Forget the certificate. Certificates mean the jack shit of nothing. Yeah? Excuse my French. So what is the future of jobs with AI in the background working behind?
I couldn't agree more. Because like, you know, I didn't go to university. I left school at 16, did an apprenticeship, I have no qualifications to speak of, right? I've got my driving license, basically. And you know, I've never used, so obviously there are people that have filtered candidates for me over time, right? So by the time I meet five people for an interview or three people for an interview, they've already been through that triage. But ultimately, I've never asked a single question about a CV. I've never asked a single question about qualifications or capabilities even. All I've looked at is attitude, right? And throughout, and I talk about this in my first book, actually, Forget Strategy, Get Results. It's about sort of taking people that have never done a job before, not looking for their skills in doing that job and going, like, do you have the right attitude here, right? Because obviously, if I'm going to ask them to do the same as they've done before, how boring is that? They're going to leave again. But if I'm going to allow them to stretch, right, and expand their capabilities and pay them for it, they're going to be loyal as hell, right? So taking people that don't have the skills but have the right attitude, for me, has always been the greatest sort of formula for success. And I think you're absolutely right. Taking advantage of being able to spend this amazing time at home and you know, never in history has this happened that you know, people are being told to stay at home and do whatever work you can do, but actually the employer is being supported by the taxpayer to allow you to do that. It's absolutely incredible. Let's not waste this opportunity, because I've got this book here I was gonna show you. So this talks about working from home. I don't know if you can see, this talks about working from home. And there's another book of mine. And in here is one particular thing about kind of the rate of change is meaning that an average 14-year-old today will have 30 jobs, 40 jobs in their life in 3 to 4 different careers, right? And if we think about the way that you and I even sort of thought about careers, you kind of go on, whether it's planned or unplanned, you're going down a direction and you might have 6, 7, 8 jobs, but they're always in that kind of same space. And now, as we spoke about before, you know, when you know, all driverless cars come in, and driving is the biggest employer in the US, full stop, you know, be that trucks or buses or taxis or whatever, all of those people are going to need another job, right? So what are they going to do? Now, you know, and by the way, you know, Uber has only just come along a few years ago, and that was suddenly creating a load of jobs for ex-bankers that suddenly then didn't have a job from the financial crisis, and they went into taxi driving, and now they're not going to have a job again. So the you know, this whole concept of having multiple careers, not multiple jobs, has to be sort of accepted by humankind, and then using online education and our ability to sort of just have a YouTube view like this of any subject we can possibly think of is so empowering. Yeah. And the kind of thing is, what, you know, what is, you've almost got to think to yourself, what are people going to want tomorrow that I can be useful in today, right? And that is a tough call, but it is what will articulate or differentiate tomorrow's successes from today's.
I'm just grinning because we both get, like, this topic, we're totally on the same one with this. It's with pretty much a lot of stuff we talk about, because it's down to the data, right? And right now, you know, someone should come up, if anyone's listening to this, they need to come up with an education tech questionnaire, right? That questionnaire asks you 10 questions, gets put into AI. Those questions then suggest potential things that you might be good at. Then you go to the 10 things you might be good at. You go, oh, that sounds good. And you push a button. What happens? You have a course, right? Is anyone doing it? Are they?
Well, you know, if you look at sort of the most popular, if you kind of go onto a job site at the moment, a tech job site, right? Now, back in the day, it might have said apprenticeship and all this sort of stuff. Now it's HTML programming. That didn't exist 10 years ago. Yeah. You know, most of the jobs that people are getting today didn't even exist. So, you can't even plan for, if you're planning for a job that already exists, you're probably behind the curve on that. So you've got to plan for imagining what could be the future and then trying to create a value in it. And,
yeah.
And you'll be effectively caught up by need.
Yeah. And you just got to run with it. If you're enjoying the feeling that it gives you, like I'm doing a podcast every day here, 5 days a week, maybe six. And I'm interviewing amazing people. Yeah. You know, and it's super interesting.
And isn't it a learning curve as well, isn't it? Just having those conversations.
You're not kidding.
No, I must admit that, you know, I chair Europe's largest podcast platform, Audioboom. And, you know, the stuff that we see on there, obviously there's a lot of, you know, there's things like No Such Thing as a Fish and All Things Comedy and all these great, you know, comedic podcasts. And then there's the sort of sports stuff, which is talking about specifics. And these are all real life, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the stuff that people come up with, which is bizarre, right? And you kind of think, what on earth are you talking about? Halfway through, you think, right, now I know what you're talking about. Because what they're doing is they're leading you down a path that you've not gone down before mentally. And you know, the challenge is hanging in, because eventually you get there, you understand what they're talking about. But at the beginning, you say, this is way beyond me. I don't understand what you're even trying to, you know, but you've got to hang in, and things in your mind's always working if you allow it to. And things start dropping into place and you go, I get it now. I'm thinking about this. So, you know, exposing yourself, like you're saying, these online courses, you know, exposing yourself to stuff that is outside of your comfort zone is super important.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, no one ever, you know, progressed by living in their comfort zone, right? And we've got this unique, hopefully never to be repeated environment that's going to last for the next probably couple of months at least.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, we're sitting here now, the UK's just gone into lockdown today, and it's not even lockdown. I mean, you know, go out for one exercise a day. Everyone's going to say, well, this is my one time a day if they get stopped.
People have no respect. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Really. I mean, my friend in Italy, he lives in Italy, English guy, teaches English. Yeah. And he recorded this video for me the other day, and he's just like, and he went into, it was brilliant. Yeah. I'll upload it to YouTube and share it with you privately. But he was basically swearing. He's going, you've got no effing respect in the UK. Look at this. This is an Italian supermarket. And he walks around it. It's completely full. Yeah. There's toilet rolls. There's everything.
Yeah.
But here, we're people are stupid. Yeah. On a lot of people, they are selfish, and they are
as well. You know, and a lot of people are, and a lot of people aren't. I think that's important to know as well, because if you go on, there's a great app called Nextdoor. And in the UK, I know this is seeing globally, but in the UK, and I'm sure there's similar ones in other countries, but basically it creates communities around physical environments. So my local area, you log in, put your local area, and then people talk about stuff going on in the local area. And the amount of people just saying, you know, I live here, and any people that want me to deliver food for them and stuff, yeah, so you don't go out. So aged people at risk, they know that there's someone literally five doors away.
Oh, wow.
That can go and, you know, because, you know, there's no point in trying to find someone that lives 3 miles away to go and deliver you, you know, on a daily basis.
No.
So, but if they're literally next door, there's no skin off their nose if they're going to go to the supermarket anyway to bring you something back, right?
Yeah.
But these communities that, by the way, that the internet is creating for us, right? Because the real world can't even walk outside. So these communities that are being created are there. Now, the question is, does the 70-year-old use the internet enough to realize that that community is online for them, right? And this is the challenge that we have where, as I say, that the rate of change in technology is far surpassing our mental ability to change, right? And so, you know, we never, ever take advantage of all the technology around us, but I think it's super important that we try, because the tools out there are far greater than we can possibly fix without technology.
Oh, very much so.
But you know, it's you know, and coming back to the point, I mean, you know, people are being extremely stupid. I mean, you know, why do you need all that toilet paper if you can't get food?
Right? I even bought nine toilet rolls.
Process. If you don't put food in, there's no shit coming out. You don't need toilet paper, right? So just say, right, you don't need like 25 rolls if you can't get any food in your mouth, right? So
I bought nine. I normally buy six. Yeah, I'm a culprit. I'm guilty of buying three extra toilet rolls, and they had aloe vera.
Well, the funny thing is that before I went on my trek on New Year's Eve, when no one knew about this, right, I actually bought a pack because I was going to take loo roll with me. In the South Pole, right, you're not allowed to leave anything on the entire continent of Antarctica.
Yeah,
so you
yeah.
crap in a bag and carry it with you.
Yeah.
You can't leave anything. So I bought all this loo roll and wet wipes and everything. But I made a mistake when I did my order, and I bought like 50 flipping rolls. And in those days, you could order as much as you like, right? This was in December. So
You're all right for a few months.
We haven't, I was too scared to say that now because we'd probably get burgled for our toilet paper. But I actually made an error that my wife was going like, "You're an idiot, why you bought all this?" And I'm going, "I'm sorry, it's there now," right? So, and now we're sitting there happy as Larry because we've got all this extra loo paper that's probably going to last us till December next year. But it wasn't done in a hoarding. It was an error of, you know, when I was able to do it. But anyway, so and by the way, wet wipes on the South Pole are completely useless as well, right?
Oh yeah.
I used to sleep with them in my sleeping bag, right, to try and keep them marginally moist.
Yeah.
And then you dig a hole, and then once a day you open this plastic bag and you kind of take a dump in it, and then from taking these wet wipes out and then taking one out of the packet to there, it's frozen in my hand.
Oh. Right?
It's frozen solid. So it's not so much of a wet wipe as a wet scrape. Right? You're basically scraping off,
bringing it in and wrapping
it, bagging it, ziplock, and in the sledge, man. And that sledge gets heavier because your food essentially is like astronaut food, and it's dehydrated food. And then obviously every day you're melting snow, rehydrating the food, eating it and crapping it out. And so your sledge is getting heavier over time because you're converting dehydrated food to rehydrated food. And it's just nuts. But anyway, so you know, wet wipes become wet scrapes at minus 50 very quickly.
That's nasty. So you must have felt like that guy in the old Carlsberg advert. He comes out of the desert and goes out as a beer. Have you seen that film?
No, I haven't seen that one.
It's an old film. And they go, he takes a Land Rover or two across the desert. It's a really old, like 1950s black and white. And he comes out the other side, and then he basically gets into this bar, and he sits down, and they pour him this pint of extra cold Carlsberg, and he sits there.
Yeah.
And I think they used it for the advert, yeah? And he sat there, and I can just imagine, like, your first beer or whatever must have been amazing, yeah. Right?
Well, the first shower was incredible. We didn't change for 2.5 weeks. Right? It was just too cold to get to take. Even in the tent stopped the wind, but it was still minus 40. You know, you don't change. You know, it just the first shower was amazing. You know, having a beer was great. Yeah, just little things, though. You know, just having normal food that isn't kind of like baby food, like mush that's dehydrated, rehydrated crap. Yeah, it's just incredible. But but again, in the great scheme of things, these are first world problems.
Yeah, completely. Well, thanks, Mike. You've been so generous with your time as usual.
No, not at all.
Really appreciate it. And I just need you to help me to record a promo video in a second. Okay. Take 1 minute. Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.